most of us here are members of a church that has existed unbroken for over 100 years. It was founded on, for the gospel's sake, and it's been a stage for the gospel ever since. That's somewhat remarkable. Without a doubt, Mike's preaching and leadership at this church provided a renewed heavenly direction and intensity that we've all benefited from, either directly or indirectly. There have been hundreds of members of this body over the years, and there have been thousands of people reached by the gospel over those years. I'm not aware of this church's history ever clinging to any kind of apostasy or serious error. There have certainly been some people who left the church who were living or teaching in error over the many years, but they've not provided any kind of long-term leadership. Now, not all churches are like this. I know of one church that had one of the greatest preachers in all of history. The church was started by that pastor. He grew the church until it was one of the largest churches in a large metropolitan city. This church did church planning in other communities. The teaching of the gospel was a very high priority in that congregation. They would listen to preaching for hours in less than air-conditioned settings. They would give up sleep in order to hear the preaching. It looked like the church was as solid as a rock. Amazing miracles, the real kind, happened at that church. But there were weaknesses, even at the beginning. They were just small weaknesses. They didn't seem like a big deal. But this church was warned several times about the evil that would creep into it. In fact, they were even told how the enemy planned to infiltrate the church. They were told ahead of time, this is what is going to happen. This is the evil that is coming at you. They were warned ahead of time what to look out for. And as far as we can tell, that church did not last 100 years. Whatever the case, it didn't last very much longer than that. Have you guessed the church that I'm talking about? Is the church at Ephesians, the church at Ephesus, which is in modern-day Turkey. I think the percentage of people in that area that worship Christ is less than 1% today. It's made up of 99% Muslim. What happened? According to Revelation, they left their first love. And that love was the love of Christ, the love of Christ. Essentially, the Ephesians failed to do what Paul is telling us in Philippians to do. They quit running the race. They quit putting on the qualities of Christ. And they got sidetracked into other stuff. And it wasn't because of the preaching or teaching. They couldn't blame it on that. They allowed the enemy into the church, and then the elders did not properly defend the body from those false teachers. First, the church lost its shared mindset of loving Christ, which is exactly what Paul is telling the Philippians to do, and then they were deceived, and then they fell. From a worldly perspective, the devil has a lot of advantages. Paul tells the Philippians in our text to stand fast. He says, stand fast. The wording means to hold your position under attack. I remember listening to a football coach talking to the front line. He would continually emphasize they had to hold their ground. They had to hold their ground. They had to stand fast. They could not allow anyone to move them from their position. In the military, it means the bravery to look at the oncoming forces, and while everything in you wants to run, you face the incoming enemy and you will not let them get past. Well, Paul is telling this to the Philippians. Why? Why is it so necessary for him to repeat this over and over and over again to everybody he ministers to? Isn't telling them once enough? I mean, surely they understood it. Surely we understand it. Well, there's a problem. Like I said earlier, the devil appears to have a lot of advantages. He has the world system of which he is in charge. The world system has all kinds of influences and resources to sidetrack believers. It offers all its wares to believers with the promise that happiness can be found here. It operates by rules that violate what God says. It even has its own mindset of I am and there is none besides me. We call it humanism. So the devil offers the world to believers, similar to how he tempted Jesus. Then all believers have a built-in struggle with flesh. Even if there were no other human alive, even if the devil did not surround us with a world run by his rules, we would still be hard-pressed. You who have small children see that every day. You didn't put that rebellion and resistance to authority in your kids. That's a gift that showed up in that small bundle of joy. It came with the package. Eyes, mouth, ears, fingers, flesh nature. So, Bodie Bauckham calls them vipers and diapers. I like that. But anyway, so God gave them parents partly to keep the whole planet from being destroyed by them. And you teach them to resist the flesh. And while you are resisting the flesh, you are teaching them to resist the flesh at the same time. So the devil's got that going for him. And then the devil has himself and all of his demons. It would be interesting to know how often we have really been under demonic attack. I'd be really curious to know that from a spiritual perspective. And I certainly don't want to make light of that thing, because it is a thing for certain. But I think much of the time, the devil is content with most people to just allow the flesh in the world to do his lion's share of the work. Maybe he reserves his greatest attacks for those who are dedicated to barging into the gates of hell to rescue those who are trapped there. I don't know. But I know a Christian can never say, the devil made me do it. The devil does not have that power over a Christian. That power plug is unplugged. So if we do something, we do it because we want to, not because we have to. So every member of every church wakes up every day to the lure of the world, to the lure of the flesh, and to the attack of the devil. Now, what would you expect with that being the case? Failure. I think that's fairly realistic. We would expect some failure. And in the church, what does that failure produce? The failure produces instability. It produces wavering. It produces danger. It produces the potential for great failure. So what must any good minister do? Well, we need to keep bringing ourselves and all those we love back to the love of Christ. We have to keep coming back to something. And that something is our relationship with Christ. It is setting our minds somewhere other than where our minds want to go. It means setting our focus where our focus doesn't naturally go. It means directing our hearts to eternity instead of the here and now. It means doing that one thing that both Jesus and Paul tell us to do. And it has to be continual, because the attack is continual. The lure is continual. It has to be constant. We cannot expect to drift into spiritual well-being. You don't drift into it. We fight our way into our spiritual directions. And sometimes, well, the world, the flesh, or the devil, or a combination of all three, get their foot in the door. And what does it look like? It looks like the relationship between these two solid, mature, established Christians of Euodia and Suntuke. It took a while to get that one memorized. And we say, no, that can't be, you know. These are the established ladies. They're the veteran ministers. They're the ones that God used to grow the church. They're the ones we look up to. Yep, that's exactly it. We're never beyond the reach of the world, the flesh, and the devil. And that's our context this morning. We're looking at the kinks in the armor of a solid church. And Paul's not going to let this ride because he fully knows the devil's intention for that church. The devil wants to destroy it, and he will use any opportunity that he can to do so. Many of us have experienced splitting wood. And we may hit the wood with the first blow, and it does nothing. And then we think, I don't know. So we hit it again, and a tiny crack shows up. And when that tiny crack shows up, you know you've got it licked now. We know that if we put a wedge in that tiny crack and we drive it, pretty soon that log is going to split apart. Sometimes it'll be dramatic. And that's very satisfying when you're splitting wood. Well, that is how the devil is in churches. He wants us to have unreconciled issues that we harbor in our relationships with each other. He wants resentment and bitterness to grow. He wants there to always be discomfort in the fellowship in a bad sort of way. He wants us to be avoiding fellowship due to perceived or real slights or sins. And he does not want either party to be the party to take the steps to heal the rift. He wants ego to reign. He wants the for and against factions to be created and then to grow. And he ultimately wants that division to grow and grow until it rips the church apart. Paul knows the devil's strategy far too well to sit back and watch this happen. Okay, with that view of the context, let's go to the text. Paul starts with a therefore, so we know that he's building on what he has already said. And he has told us that Paul is pushing on to know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death. That's what the Christian life is all about, that pushing forward. And then he tells us how he pours every energy every day into winning this race, the prize of the upward call of God. He has explained that to us, and now he is applying it. The first sentence in the verse, in verse 1, had to be very encouraging, amazingly encouraging to the people who are having this letter read to them. Paul addresses them by saying, "My beloved and longed-for brethren, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, beloved." Now, if you're an English teacher, you're going to tell your student, go back and rewrite that sentence. I've read this, that this sentence is as unusual in the Greek as it is in English. It starts with beloved and ends with beloved. The word for beloved is the richest, deepest, and strongest word for love. It is agapetos, or something like that. Paul is telling them, you are the people I love with agape love. It's that kind of love that simply will not relent in using what we have for another's best interest. And the Philippians are the object of that love. It's a bit hard to imagine how a fellowship can fail if both parties hold this kind of love toward each other. Agape kind of love. The love that says how you respond isn't the important thing. That I do that which is in your best interest is the important thing. Flesh will mess up these kind of relationships because flesh always looks at a relationship for what's in it for me. But agape love exists to do benefit that is not contingent upon the response of the beloved. Agape is a self-contained source of love that loves despite the response it creates. Agape initiates. It needs no coercion. So the lover takes on more significance than the lovely attributes of the beloved. It's like how Christ loved us. He loved us when we were enemies. We had no virtue that won him to us. He loved us because he loved us. Christ loves us with the agape love. Now, why does Christ love us? It has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with Christ. Here Paul tells the Philippians that this is the kind of love he has for them. I'm writing you this letter because I love you. It's not because you respond to me, it's because I want to do what is best for you and I will spend myself to give to do it. And for Paul, it's not just a matter of conviction, like mental conviction. That's a wonderful thing. When we do the right thing for the right reason, even though we're kind of dreading doing it, but we're still doing it for the right reason, that's great. But Paul bumps that up a notch. He receives pleasure from this as well. The loving that he is doing, he is also receiving pleasure from. They are dear to Paul. When I hear that kind of language, I think of how Ruth uses that term, dear. Like we can probably all imagine hearing her say it, even. It's just, she conveys what she means by the way she says the word. She refers to people as being dear to her, and when she says it, you know exactly what she means. That's what's meant here. These people were dear to Paul. And Paul makes it a beloved sandwich. He starts with the word beloved and he ends with the word. These people are very loved. And he's trying to make that point, and they probably got it. Paul builds on this idea of dearness when he says, longed for brethren. Longed for brethren. Have you ever deeply missed someone? Brad often speaks of his departed family members, and it's easy to see that he misses them longingly. I sometimes miss my dad that way. When I've not seen my kids for a while, I feel that way. And I get urges that I just want to be with that person. That's what Paul is conveying here. Then he says this, my joy and my crown. My joy and my crown. We often see that Paul finds joy in those that he ministers to. And why not? They're some of the riches that he is storing up in heaven. They are eternal. They are part of the eternal environment that he is going to be in. He is seeking first those things that are above. And these are the fruit of his labor. It's not something that moth and rust will corrode or thieves can steal. So it's an apt source of joy. When we're setting our affections on heaven, we're also setting our affections on the people that we will share it with. The word for crown is interesting. The crown is not a kingly crown. It's more like a wreath or a laurel that one wins as a prize for winning a race. These believers are going to be a heavenly crown, a heavenly reward for Paul. They represent the fruit of Paul's labor, and they just won't win him a crown. They are his crown. Their presence in eternity will be a profoundly rewarding thing for Paul for all the work that he did. He counts them that way now, knowing that this is what they'll be like in eternity. Growing up, there were times I was taught that I had to witness. You know, a Christian has to witness. And that was a lot of times the scope of what we would hear. So you would feel guilty if you didn't, and you better get out there and do it, and that's your primary thing. It was my obligation as a Christian to witness. But I didn't regard it as much that it was my opportunity to witness. Witnessing is a chance for a crown. It's a chance for my minutes and hours to be converted into a human being who will live forever, and I had the glorious opportunity to play a small part in all of that. I think we all do well to consider this when we rub shoulders with the world. We may have opportunity to play a part in winning an eternal crown like this. Well, the Philippians were just that. They were a source of joy and a source of reward to Paul. Now, after telling them how Paul regards them, he tells them this. So stand fast in the Lord. He's telling them, hold your position, because your position will be challenged. It will be threatened. There is opposition. This implies that standing fast does not just happen. It constantly takes effort. It's an expectation we should have when we wake up every morning. We're waking up to new mercies, the new mercies of God. We're waking up to the grace of God to come to us throughout that day, and we are waking up to enmity. We are waking up to a battle. All these things are true. So we can expect opposition even to our relationships between each other. That is good to know, and that's a repeated theme in Philippians. Hold your ground. We do well to take this to heart. We can't assume that our natural responses to each other are godly responses. We can't assume that just because I'm angry with you, that means I have good reason to be angry with you. Maybe I'm just angry. Maybe I'm just selfish. We can't assume that because I think a person did a thing for a specific reason, that they actually did that thing for that specific reason. How many times in marriage do we find we're completely wrong about that? We can't trust our perceptions. We have got to continually bring everything in our relationships back to the Word of God. And often we have work that needs done in our relationships, as we'll see in the very next verse. That leads into verse 2. I implore Euodia and I implore Suntuke to be of the same mind in the Lord. Now, how do you think you would feel if you were sitting in the audience at Philippi, waiting to hear this letter that you just got in from God, from Paul, and suppose you were Euodia and Suntuke? Wow. Were they called out or what? They probably had no idea they were included in this letter. It's very, very rare that Paul does this. It's rare that he uses someone's name when he's addressing their need of discipline in a letter. But he does it here. And it might be because they were in some kind of leadership that ups the ante. Because leaders are dealt with differently when they're being disciplined than anybody else. But I think part of the reason for this, well, like I just said, is that they were leaders of some sort. And maybe they're being held up as an example in the Philippians church. But for some reason, these women had a falling out. And there are a lot of good guesses as to why, but nobody really knows for sure what the whole deal was. I think it's safe to assume that the differences weren't based on a kind of core doctrine, core difference. If one of the women was right about something that was core and the other one was wrong, Paul wouldn't have dealt with both of them. Could it be a secondary doctrine that they were arguing about? Maybe one was leading more towards submission to the Old Testament laws pertaining to the Jewish people, and the other was leaning away from it. That was a common problem they had. Depending upon the degree and the scope, that wouldn't be a core doctrine dispute, but it would still be something they would have to work out between them. Or maybe they had deeply personally offended one another, and neither was willing to see or confess the wrong that they had done, or to even go about trying to reconcile. It's difficult to know. All we know for sure is that being of the same mind in the Lord was the answer to the problem. It might be that everything Paul said up to this point was preparing for this single point of correction. I never really thought about that before. But a commentary pointed it out. I thought, you know, it could be. It was that significant of a thing that Paul lays a tremendous groundwork before he gets to this point. He laid out how we must have the same mind as Christ. We have to be willing to see ourselves as expendable the same way Christ did. We have to be willing to do the will of the Father the same way that Christ did. These women had somehow elevated their differences to the place that their differences were of greater importance than the glory of Christ. Their egos and their stands on their positions were of greater importance than the gospel work that needed done. If either would take on the same mind as Christ, movement would start to happen. It's like this in all relationships. If our pride is stopping us from entering into a conversation about the issue, we should put the glory of Christ and the importance of his church as a higher priority than our pride. We can hold to the position all day if we want that I should not have to initiate reconciliation because it's not my fault there's a problem. And it's interesting that Jesus tells both the one who sinned and the one who is sinned against to initiate the conversation. He doesn't allow one to have an opt-out. The church is like that. The church is that important. Even sometimes when we know something is not our fault, we'll start the conversation in an effort to get reconciliation. What's the alternative? It's like that tiny little crack in the wood that doesn't look like much at all. Until the devil puts a wedge in that crack and he starts pounding. This is not about our rights. The church is built on the church's very founder, Jesus Christ, not claiming any rights for himself. And that is the one that we should have the same mind as. He didn't do anything wrong. He could easily sat in heaven saying, I didn't start that. I'm not going to mess with that. That's their problem. So we don't have a great leg to stand on if we're hoping to claim our rights of not being the kid that started the fight. When we take on the same mind as Christ, we have as much chance of reconciliation as can be reached. When both parties take on the same mind as Christ, there is no division that cannot be resolved, even if it means to agree to disagree and to continue loving one another. I don't think in the Church of Christ, or in our church for that matter, we all see eye to eye about everything. Even in our small church, we have differences of opinion about things. But when those things we disagree on cause us to begin to harbor bitterness, or envy, or anger, or frustration that disturbs true fellowship, it's time to get to work on the issue. Evidently, that's what's happening in Philippi with these two women. And as being examples in the church, the leadership could not afford to let this flow. To create in the minds of the people at Philippi, well, this is just an example of how the members of the church should be. That's what you expect at church. He's not going to let that fly. I think that's why they were called out in the letter. Paul is letting everyone know that their behavior is not acceptable. That is not Christian behavior. That is not Christ-like. And look at Paul's wording. He says, I implore you. I implore you. It's like Paul is begging these women. If they don't do it because they think it's important, then do it because Paul, who they know is trustworthy and wise, believes they should do it, and he is begging them to do it. Sometimes we as Christians find ourselves in Paul's spot. Over time, we develop regard from other believers. I'm sure we all have relationships like that. They respect us. Maybe we've done a lot of things for them. And there comes a time when that person really needs a push to do the thing that you can see is the right thing for them to do. Sometimes we must use all the influence we have to get them to do the next step, even if they're not completely certain about it. I think of the story that Diane tells about Mike talking to her about doing Bible quizzing. And that kind of a story where, you know, he pretty much put a strong arm in. Because he had influence, he used influence. Sometimes people will do the right thing because they trust us enough to take our advice. Now, we need to be really careful that when we give that push, that we use it for something that we know is in their best interest. When we have that kind of influence with others, we should use it like Paul used it. Sometimes that can push just someone over that hurdle, one they would not have crossed by themselves. Not sure, though, that we want to usually start by putting their names in a church-wide letter. That's pretty harsh. Now look, Paul pulls in reinforcements. First, he begs the women to work it out, but he's not content to let it there. This is important enough that he's going to provide some accountability to them as well. And sometimes we have to do the same. Sometimes we need mediation. You know, I sometimes think that a lot of stuff in marriage could be solved a whole lot quicker if we use mediation more, if we used a third party that could hear both sides and help us out. But anyway, sometimes we need mediation, and sometimes we need a kick in the pants. And sometimes we need continual encouragement, and sometimes we need a mix of all three of those things. But often this influence comes with a face. Verse 3, and I urge you, true companion, help these women who labored with me in the gospel. So, Paul in the same letter is urging somebody to help the process. No one knows for sure who that true companion is. There are lots of theories. Most think that it's probably not one of the Philippians. I think it was someone who was on Paul's team. He was probably a normal traveling companion with Paul. And based on the evidence in the book of Acts, the timing would fit very well for Luke to have been at Philippi when this letter arrived. So let's suppose it was Luke. We don't know that it was, but let's suppose that it was Luke. When the letter is read, everyone would know that there was only one of Paul's team present. So they and Luke would immediately know who Paul was talking about. Not sure I would be too happy to hear this was my next assignment. Working out disagreements among people is always difficult because both parties almost always have a reason for what they're doing. They're not in this position because, you know, they couldn't think of a solution. Personally, I think working out problems between females is a little more perplexing than with males, but that might just be my perspective. Anyway, whoever it is that Paul addresses knows that he has a job to do. My guess is no one wanted to touch this problem because it was going to be difficult to get these women to see eye to eye. But sometimes ministers are given assignments out of the blue to wrestle with dragons, and we just have to say, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord, I'll do it. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'll do it. And he goes, help these women who labored with me in the gospel. I was looking at the Greek word for help, and it was interesting to me that many of the uses of the word are translated to seize. To seize. I guess there was something about the context that translators chose to say to help. But even that means to take hold together with one. It looks very much like Paul's fellow worker is being given a formidable assignment, and it may take more than kind words to accomplish his end goal. I think it's good to see here, too, that we must always be pressing on with the next step to the finish line. You know, you think about these women. They had quite a history. It looks like these ladies may have stopped pressing on and got their eyes off the finish line and started looking behind them. I wonder if we were to ask them about their spiritual lives, if they would have said, well, we were very instrumental in Paul's ministry at Philippi. Their spiritual life was primarily past tense, or it could have been. And while Paul says this is definitely true, they were definitely a huge help, that's never enough. Just like he says, we must press on. These women did great work. But that doesn't count for the next step. Looking back at that means nothing now if they will not continue to make the next step. They've got to press forward, and they must do what God has for them to do today, which happens to be working out a relationship that both of them are going to probably have to humble themselves. And what God has for them today is reconciliation. And sometimes that's very hard to do when we have removed our focus from the finish line and we have forgotten about being of the same mind as Christ. So a very easy application today is this. Is there anyone at our church or any other Christian, for that matter, that we will not take the means at our disposal to reconcile with, even though we know we need that reconciliation? And that doesn't mean that, you know, every little myth or anything like that, every single little thing needs to be worked out. But if we're carrying it and it's affecting that relationship, are we willing to? Are we harboring evil attitudes toward anyone? Self-pity, bitterness, contempt, superiority, whatever. Is your fellowship hindered with anyone due to something either that you have done to them or that you perceive they have done to you? Well, guess whose responsibility it is to address that? It's yours. Doesn't matter whose fault. It's yours. And Paul is imploring you this morning, do something about it. If we have such a thing as that in our lives, will we? Will we ask God, Lord, reveal to me if I am harboring any of this stuff and if I need to do business with it? And also, we're told to stand fast. Are we recognizing the importance of holding our position every day against the forces of the world, the flesh, and the devil? Those forces are unrelenting, so we must push forward on a daily basis. Is that how we are approaching life? Is that how we are viewing life? May God grant us courage to face the battles ahead this week, whether it be the world, the flesh, and the devil, or whether it be a tiny crack created by a problem in our relationship. Let's close in prayer. Lord, we thank you again for our friend Paul and what helpful information he gives us and how he's so bold about making sure that your church is taken care of. Help us to follow that example, to be that courageous and that relentless like we see Paul being. Help us to have the courage to delve into conversations about relationships if they are not what they ought to be, and if we are hindered in our fellowship with you or fellowship with each other because of them. And Lord, help us to incorporate this truth that every day we are in a battle, that we wake up to a battle, and you graciously give us everything that we need to face that battle. But help us to do our part. Help us to take part in that battle and to have the kind of attitude that it takes to be victorious. We thank you and we praise you. We know that we were brought to you by your decision, and that we continue knowing that you are the author and the perfecter of this faith that we have. And we just rely upon you to help us in making the changes that are necessary to most glorify you. In Jesus' name.